It is crunch time, the Wednesday edition on 95.3 The Score. Let's talk some football, a little Last Dance. He's the fine analyst for the Pac-12 Network, also 670 The Score in Chicago, covering the Bears. You can follow along on Twitter, use the handle at Big Ant Heron. We welcome in Anthony Heron. Anthony, how is life treating you and yours during these, let's call it, most unique times?
Yeah, that's probably about as accurate a way to describe it as we're going to get, Steve. Overall, good, man. I'd say when the weather's agreeable in Chicago, which is not the case on a daily basis, but we can get our two-year-old outside, we walk around a bit, head up to Grant Park, we put our masks on, and still able to keep some good distance from folks when we do it, and, you know, get a, I suppose, not necessarily cardio, but at least get a bit of activity getting outside for a quick walk before we head back. But overall, good. Supplies are plenty, and while there's not necessarily live sporting events going on to the extent that we're accustomed to, we're still able to keep entertained enough.
All right. Good to hear. So as an Illinois guy from a Chicago suburb, if my math is right, this Last Dance documentary about the Bulls, that sounds like that's right in your wheelhouse for maybe the time you were in middle school through when you started playing at Iowa. So how much are you loving this trip down memory lane?
It's so much fun. It really is. And to, what's interesting to me is to sort of experience the nation watching the Bulls dynasty in the 90s, sort of the, you know, not necessarily the infancy of my sports fandom, but certainly my formative years when I was really becoming an athlete, starting to compete in organized sports while the Bulls were the best thing going seemingly on the planet at that time. And so to see a couple decades later now, folks experience what that was like, and to be able to discuss it with people and get the perspective on fans who were sports fans, who were certainly aware of and familiar with the Bulls, but perhaps because they were outside the Chicago area, didn't necessarily have the full depth of knowledge of some of the storylines of everything going on. So it's great for me individually to relive it in knowing a lot of the inner workings of what was happening, but also to kind of watch everyone else experience it, in some cases for the first time, especially with the younger crowd.
Yeah, it's been fun, the reaction. You had something to say on Twitter I thought was spot on about Jordan as a baseball player. I mean, he played when he was 17, then not for 14 years, made Double-A. You know, he's among the team leaders in RBI. And like his manager, Terry Francona, said, he was still developing. So you thought it might have been interesting if they kind of delved a little deeper into Michael, number 45, right fielder.
I really would have got a kick out of that. There's certain things where, you know, I think they really did a great job with the Dennis Rodman storyline from the first weekend and Scottie Pippen, and just getting a sense for who those individuals were. But then there's certain aspects where I would love to have seen a little more of Tony Kukoc's backstory, what it was like for him growing up and as things split and he went on to the Croatian side of things, not just his basketball career in the Olympics and becoming a Bull, but just what was his path in coming to America. I would have loved to have seen them take more depth into Kukoc's life in the way that they did with Pippen and with Rodman early in the series. And I think that Jordan's baseball background, Jordan's baseball time in the minor leagues there, it felt like they gave you sort of the brush by points, kind of a couple of the main bullets of what was going on, and then moved pretty quickly back to Baker Square and his time in rejoining the Bulls, which was fun, but I think it would have really been cool because we think now, decades later, you tend to hear folks discuss Jordan's time with the Birmingham Barons and in the minor leagues as a massive failure and as though he was just this sham of a baseball player. And when you consider everything, like you referenced, he didn't play the game for 14 years. He's 6'6 with a fairly wiry frame, so kind of an awkward baseball build anyway. He ended up being a more than competent minor league baseball player in just over a year. It's remarkable what he accomplished throughout his time in the minors and what he ended up becoming. So I would have really enjoyed been getting into that in a little bit more detail.
Now, I'm with you on that one. I thought another interesting aspect is the way they portrayed the general manager, Jerry Krause, who died 3 years ago. I mean, he was kind of an easy target. We know he had sort of a villainous side, but he also hired Phil Jackson, sold the triangle offense, drafted Pippen. They did win 6 titles. What did you think of how he was kind of portrayed in the documentary?
I think that's the thing where the fact that it's posthumous at this point makes it kind of difficult for Jerry Krause and his family, you know, those who love and cared about him. I actually got a chance to talk to BJ Armstrong on my radio show today. And to be able to address that part of it directly with BJ, and you know, he's the guy who ended up working with the Bulls organization afterwards, and Jerry Krause brought him on as one of the Bulls executives. And there are a lot of folks who have a lot of great respect for what Jerry Krause accomplished. It was just the relationship aspect of it. You know, some of the things that were covered in the documentary, the organizations win championships, not players. When you don't necessarily have a personal touch with the main guys on your squad, then it's kind of like everything else. Not only the guys in your locker room, but really the collective media around and covering the Bulls. And it wasn't just the Chicago media. They were such a national brand that the national media viewed Jerry Krause in a fairly negative light, largely because he really wasn't able to build a bond with the main players on the team.
We're talking with Anthony Herron of the Pac-12 Network. You mentioned Rodman, so it's the last year. He's already won two titles with the Pistons, two with the Bulls. He's living his life. He's got the attention of the world. He's playing with Jordan, and he's walking down the hall, and he says, "I'm bored." What was your reaction to that guy saying he's bored?
Well, when you watched the energy that Dennis Rodman played the game with, and, you know, you've got listeners, I'm sure, who go all the way to the Bay Area, and thinking of, if Golden State fans look at the way Draymond Green plays the game right now, the energy he's added to that squad on the defensive end of the court, just double it at least, maybe triple it with what Dennis Rodman brought to things. You know, different style of basketball play from Draymond Green, but the type of defensive dominance that they both bring to the table is really similar. Draymond Green, in a lot of ways, because of the outsized personality and in what's an offensive sport, being kind of the defensive stalwart, especially on the interior, not because he overmatches his opponents with size, but more so with tenacity. So Draymond being, in a lot of ways, the modern-day Rodman. Dennis, though, from an energy, tenacity standpoint, really dwarfs Draymond Green. So to hear him talk about being bored, I can't imagine what, if Dennis Rodman were kind of a young pup in today's era, what he would be diagnosed with, whether ADD, ADHD, whatever types of things that medical professionals would say about him, because you would think that for him, the sort of manic nature that he competed with and him diving all over the place, you could tell he would get bored during the game sometimes and just do silly things just to entertain himself or to keep himself stimulated even while competing in an NBA game.
Guy is unbelievable. All right, I guess we got to talk some football. You got to see Justin Herbert many times over his 3.5 years as a starter. You obviously get to see a lot and break down NFL games. So what pops about Justin's game that would lead you to think he's got a shot at big-time success playing Sundays?
Well, I think that, you know, I've talked about the physical traits of Justin Herbert in the past. I mean, just everything. Even if he would have come out a year ago, folks would have been wowed by what he brought to the table with his stature, with his arm strength, with his mobility. He's just got extremely rare physical tools, very similar to Cam Newton, Josh Allen, athletes like that at the quarterback position. So for him, at the NFL level, what I'm really interested in watching Justin Herbert's development is, you know, we compare him to a couple of the guys I just referenced there. Cam Newton, still throughout the scope of his career, even after winning a league MVP, still hasn't completely refined himself as a passer with anticipation, with consistent touch and accuracy. And I would say the same thing right now in Josh Allen's development, where both those guys have been utilized in systems in the NFL that don't necessarily call for them to consistently throw the ball from within the pocket with touch and anticipation and take advantage of their athleticism, of their mobility. That, to me, will be the best scenario for any early success that Justin Herbert would have. What I do like about the situation he goes into is that he's not necessarily going to be called upon early. He at least won't have to be called upon early to succeed. He'll have an opportunity with Tyrod Taylor being in the meeting room there to perhaps grow into the role of becoming the starter at some point for the Chargers, but there's enough skill talent on offense, while the offensive line certainly needs some help, and they're trying to get that part done. but there's enough skilled talent on offense, and he's with an organization that I think has infrastructure in place. They're accustomed to accumulating talent. It's one of the reasons that, to me, Phillip Rivers has had a bit of a frustrating career, because there's been a lot of times while he put up huge numbers, I've always wondered how he wasn't able to break through in the playoffs more with everything that was around him. So I think Justin Herbert, he's in a great position where, for my old school sensibilities, that I prefer young quarterbacks, high draft picks, to sit the bench early, learn the NFL game, watching it for a bit before they're thrust into things. And I think Justin Herbert's really going to have a great opportunity to, with limited pressure, especially from the Chargers fan base, but in Los Angeles, isn't going to apply that much pressure to the team. But he's going to have that chance, I think, to truly be sort of patiently moved into the lineup once he earns it, as opposed to having the pressure to immediately come in and start.
Yeah, I love the situation he landed in. A little to the north, I think you got to see Oregon State play like three times this past season alone.
Yeah,
See Jake Luton went in the sixth round to Jacksonville like Gardner Minshew a year ago. I mean, you and Roxy got to call his monster game at UCLA. What do you like about his skill set that'll transfer to Sundays?
You know what? I mean, it won't surprise me at all. Now, you know, as much as Gardner Minshew is there, and we're seeing Jacksonville put themselves in a position where, you know, they essentially are saying that he's the guy for now, for the move they made at quarterback, moving on from Nick Foles. And at this point, if between Gardner Minshew, Mike Glennon, Josh Dobbs, Jake Luton, right now Gardner Minshew certainly has the inside track, but it's a fairly crowded quarterback meeting room with a lot of guys that are still fairly young. Like right now, Mike Glennon is the oldest guy in the Jaguars QB room. But I think it's a good position for Jake Luton to be drafted into, because he's got a couple of other guys of similar sort of stature and athleticism to him, while at the same time you've got the comparison where you got Gardner Minshew and Josh Dobbs, who both move around a bit more in the pocket. So I think it's going to be a really interesting quarterback room, and for him, the talent he brings to the table, he's certainly got an NFL arm, and when he's healthy, he's got an NFL ability to move around the pocket, extend plays as well. So for me, in watching what played out with him at the collegiate level, I called the game where it looked like perhaps his football career may have been over, so it was really gratified to watch what he accomplished this past season, and I've got every confidence that there, even though being a late-round pick, that he's going to have the potential to step into the NFL and earn a roster spot and perhaps develop into a guy who can really be a contributor.
A couple final thoughts for Anthony Heron of Pac-12 Network, also covers the Bears. And, of course, the Bears made a move to kind of push Mitch Trubisky, who was up and down last year, to say the least. We've got Nick Foles in the mix, who went down early last year, and we know there's no mini camp. So somebody said, how wide open is the competition to be the Bears starter this year?
It's extremely wide open, and I would even go as far as to say, even though they ended up drafting Mitch Trubisky at number two overall, famously ahead of Deshaun Watson and Patrick Mahomes, I think at this point, they're prepared to move on from Mitch with the Nick Foles move that they made. They renegotiated his deal, so it's a little more financially friendly for the Bears organization with some of the guaranteed money that was there for him. But I think that unless Mitch Trubisky can truly come in and just kind of seize the day, give his coaching staff and his teammates, at whatever point they get onto the field, the opportunity to show that they can have every confidence in him, I really think that almost by default, they're going to lean more towards the direction of Nick Foles, because he got several coaches on the Bears staff who worked with him before in Philadelphia, who know what he can do in the postseason. What concerns me about Nick Foles is that while he's had some great late season runs and postseason runs, he never at any point in his career, when he's been asked to be the opening day starter, has been able to play well and maintain that starting position throughout the scope of an NFL season. So that's going to be the rub. I think that Trubisky's got plenty of physical talent. He's really got to, through what's going to be a difficult offseason for him, to really fully master the offense for the Bears, but he's got to take every advantage of the time he's going to have to step onto the field and play the game with confidence, to play the game ahead of the chain, to play ahead of the mental aspect of the game that up to this point has seemed to be really a struggle for him in trying to read and diagnose coverages.
Nice take there. One last thing. The rivals, the Packers, they surprised some people. Went with Jordan Love down at 26, kind of like when they took Aaron Rodgers 15 years ago. A lot of people were kind of tearing into them. What's your angle? What was your take when you heard they made that pick on draft day?
I think from an organizational standpoint, I think it made enough sense because it's pretty rarefied air for a franchise. You think of basically San Francisco and Green Bay. I suppose to some extent New England got to do it a bit from Drew Bledsoe to Tom Brady, but when you get Hall of Fame caliber quarterbacks back-to-back in that manner, it's pretty rare. So now Green Bay is saying, you know what, we're going to take the opportunity. Aaron Rodgers is older than Brett Favre was when we drafted him to move on and bring in a really talented young player. So I think organizationally, to try to go three in a row with great quarterbacks and two, like I referenced, my old school sensibilities, not have to force this young, talented guy, Jordan Love, into the lineup before he's ready. It's a great situation for Jordan Love to go into, and it works out okay for the Packers to get a young, talented guy who doesn't have to immediately step onto the field. He gets to learn from one of the best of all time. All those things being said, I think Aaron Rodgers should be upset about it. I think his teammates should be upset about it because Green Bay has never drafted a skill position guy in the first round to aid Aaron Rodgers, and they need help in those spots. Even if it wasn't going to be offensive skill, they could use help in the front seven on defense. They could have added some depth there. So for a franchise coming off of what felt like a smoke and mirror sort of 13-win season, they could have used a high-level player, a big-time contributor in the first round, and they decided not to get one. They took a first rounder who's going to sit the bench likely for multiple seasons.
Yep, they put themselves in the bullseye. So,
yeah.
Folks, he is Anthony Herrent, one of the best analysts in the business. We always appreciate your time, your insight, wishing you and yours not only health and safety, but sanity. Anthony, thanks so much for joining us, man. Appreciate it, and I hope to catch up soon.
Always my pleasure, Steve. Look forward to talking to you every time. Thanks for having me.
All right, be well.